My name is Arnold, and I'm an alcoholic. My sobriety date is June 20, 1982. I am a member of the Welcome Group of Alcoholics Anonymous, 5513 York Road in Baltimore, Maryland. We meet on Saturday evenings, and you should be preparing the coffee right about now. Please consider that an invitation to come visit us, just not all at once, because I'd like to welcome all of you this afternoon to the 2015 International Convention of Alcoholics Anonymous, and to thank you for not only your attendance at this particular workshop, but also your willingness to participate and share in the 80th anniversary celebration of our collective sobrieties. Like the other presenters, I am grateful for the opportunity to address you this afternoon on the topic of our primary purpose. Today, we seem to be discussing the same questions that we've been discussing about our primary purpose over the last 80 years. The real question we probably need to ask ourselves this afternoon is, are we fulfilling that primary purpose? I think it's probably the most important question that our newest member and our oldest old-timer can ask either in the meeting place they find themselves or in the quietness of their own home at the end of the day. The very first printing of our big book contained a foreword with this message, and I quote, "We simply wish to be helpful to those who are afflicted." This wish to be helpful arose out of the experiences of the first few recovering alcoholics because they had been transformed from useless creatures and because they felt so deeply about what Bill Wilson had said was in fact and true. Bill Wilson mentioned that we must carry this message else we ourselves wither and those who've yet to come will not be given the truth and may indeed die. In a letter written by Bill in 1946, Bill writes, "The chief purpose of AA is indeed sobriety. We all realize that without sobriety, we really don't have much." Then he went on to say, "We're not living just to be sober. We're living to learn, to serve, to love." There's no question in my mind that we may have learned and we continue to learn. We've loved and continue to love. And as I look out over this crowd today, please turn to yourselves and applaud yourselves for doing just that. On a more personal note, though, I could not find the sobriety in our fellowship until I began working the steps on a continual basis. It was a very slow process for me, but with the help and understanding love of my sponsor and my home group, my life slowly began to take shape. One of the key elements in working the steps was my willingness to change. The change in my outlook, the change in my attitude, the change in everything about me was of utmost importance. Instead of hurting the people that were most near and dear to me, I began to try to be a better person. Looking back at those early days of sobriety, I realized the importance of belonging to a home group. That is where I first learned to become responsible. Responsible for opening the meeting, for being a greeter, for being and making the coffee, for chairing a meeting. That is where I learned that the 12th step was not just some fantasy, but could be as beneficial in my life as it is to the survival of our fellowship. In my experience as a member of Alcoholics Anonymous, I've found that the importance of a home group and its role in my recovery from a seemingly hopeless state of mind and body were not just mere words. Neither were "we can do together what I cannot do alone." It's my understanding, and I believe I speak for at least some of us indeed, that a home group is responsible for providing the environment for all of us to maintain our sobriety. Additionally, the home group gives us the incentive to want to practice the 12 steps in our own recoveries. And it still can be there that we look out and find the still suffering alcoholic, be it the newer member or the older one. I was very fortunate during those days. I was surrounded by a group of AA members who wanted to give me exactly what they had been given in previous times. They wanted me to experience the potential of Alcoholics Anonymous and potential that this fellowship could do for a hopeless drunk like myself. They gave me a family. They taught me to be able to answer four basic questions. Who was my sponsor? What step was I working that day? What is the name of my home group? And indeed, what service position did I hold at this spiritual home? The men and women in my sponsorship lineage talked about sponsors and grand sponsors, brothers, sisters, uncles, aunts. It felt really good. It felt really secure. That family encouraged me in my early sobriety to meet other extended members of the family. And as I look over this hall today, I am in great company with a myriad of relatives I have yet to meet. I've had the opportunity to change home groups a few times in my sobriety, but I've been able to take the experience of that very first one and translate to selecting a new one. It seems as though there are guidelines for doing that, and in those guidelines, I become responsible for reaching out to the next person. My home group is indeed the strongest bond between me and the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous, because it's there that I see our primary purpose in action. You know, vital signs are generally associated with the medical profession. They are indeed numerical readings and observations which give indications to whether the stress or illness is increasing or subsiding, whether there's a fit condition intact for certain measures to be taken to whether a person is getting well or getting sick. Clear indicators of fit spiritual conditions of a home group are around for all of us to see. The first thing I do is I check for alertness. Much as when we go to the doctor may ask, "Do you know your name? Do you know what day it is?" I can ask those questions of my home group. The questions that I want to ask are, who is the intergroup rep? Do we have a GSR? When are the group business meetings? How does this group utilize its Seven Tradition funds? Healthy home groups are filled with members who've learned that it's the responsibility of the group to link to the Alcoholics Anonymous Fellowship as a whole. The uninvolved group can indeed get as every bit as sick as us as uninvolved members. None of us can do this alone, and an unattached group can't either. After checking for the basic alertness, I check on the health of the three legacies of Alcoholics Anonymous. I take the blood pressure of the group. At the very core, pumping life into each member of the group is indeed the legacy of recovery. That legacy is outlined in our basic text. At those home group meetings, do I hear solutions? Are references made to the uniform literature of our fellowship? Are members sharing their experience, strength, and hope? Now, at my home group, maybe like yours, you may see a few bleeding deacons with high blood pressure. Yet most of us are pretty healthy, staying very, very active, and carrying this message. The legacy of unity can be read throughout the warmth of my home group. How does my home group and how does your home group treat newcomers? Newcomers from time to time are indeed the pulse of what we do here. When we go to the doctor doesn't ask us if we had a pulse last year. We want to know if you have a pulse today. And so when I look at groups and the health of those, and the health of those in carrying our message and their primary purpose, I make sure that there's a pulse. To follow this analogy a little bit further, I look into the eyes of my home group members. You see, that's the windows of the soul. It's in those things that I can determine where there's health in traditions, number one. What's being talked about at our meetings? Is there a strong sense of our tradition, five? What happens to the wholeness of our group and our fellowship if these things are missing? Disease may crop up, as I indicated early, but strong vital signs on a regular basis and checked through our group inventory will indeed make us all stronger, all more cohesive, all more focused on our primary purpose, and all of us more focused on the God of our understanding. We all know the difference between attending a meeting and a home group. The group is where there is a haven of safety. It's a net for our emotional balance. It's a place that we can get help and also help. To strengthen groups is indeed what our primary purpose is all about. It's a worthy concept, and it's one that our goals are always focused on. All three sides of our triangle, recovery, unity, and service, coexist on equal footing, though sometimes the unity is given the short straw. If we do, in fact, give this unity a short straw, then we create an imbalance in our makeup. Our responsibility in service is to listen, to learn, to love, and to lead. But first, we must indeed take the opportunity and the time to listen. That process begins with our groups. It begins in the communication with the service structure and each other. Our traditions and our concepts place groups first. And as we look at the service manual on S23, we see the inverted triangle has our groups at the top. Our three legacies represent the sum total of the responsibilities that were given us by Bill and Bob. In the wake of Bill's spiritual awakening, Bill was gifted with a vision. Bill writes in the AA Comes of Age book on page 64 that his thoughts raced toward helping alcoholics. And he proposed to do that throughout the rest of his life. At the Sixth General Service Conference, our friend Bernard Smith quoted the Reverend C.E. Ravens when he talked about the conditions necessary for a fellowship. Reverend Ravens talks about three conditions that are necessary for a fellowship to be ideal. The conditions are the possession of a common ideal involving a complete release from selfishness and division. The discharge of a common task, a task big enough to capture the imagination and to give expression to loyalty. And lastly, the togetherness, the camaraderie, the things that we find as we come to international conventions, as we go to local conventions, as we find in our home group, that keep us involved in whole-time service are the ideals that help alcoholics remain carrying this message and becoming, realizing our primary purpose. Fulfillment of our primary purpose is an individual as well as a collective responsibility. Unified we live, disunified we don't live. Although we become impatient from time to time with our progress toward carrying this message and our primary purpose, I've always found it ironic that when I do that, newcomers don't seem to mind. Newcomers come in and they understand that the primary purpose of our fellowship is indeed to stay sober, and they go right to it, leaving people like me who are making judgments and comparisons to do just that. But all the time, I am blessed, as you are too, to share in their common collective sobrieties as we move along. We all know that we have an inexhaustible amount of newcomers coming to us, and we need to be ready to do something about that. We have daily reminders of what alcoholism and alcoholics should and should not be. Unfortunately, we are stuck with radio and TV, newspapers, and things of that like. But the symbol of our fellowship is, in fact, complete. The triangle completed by that circle. And so long as we're all responsible, when anyone, anywhere reaches out for help, we will serve ourselves and our fellowship instead. Eventually, my belonging to that home group got me involved in a different level of service, one that you see me involved in now. It started with becoming a GSR. I remember my home group going to the bathroom. I came back and he told me I'd been elected. But I remember going to my first assembly and coming back, and yes, these people really wanted to know what took place and they wanted to be attached to Alcoholics Anonymous. From that time until now, I've been literally hooked on this thing called service. I like to think that being involved in service has indeed somewhat made being sober somewhat easier, but only being easier doesn't allow me to be complacent. I say to the people that are in the sound of my voice that service is indeed a gift from our higher power. It's a privilege to all AA members. However, unfortunately, not all of us will make use of that gift. I do charge you with knowing that not to be involved in getting out of oneself and serving Alcoholics Anonymous depends on us being here for that newcomer and carrying that message to the still suffering alcoholic. In summary, I believe that all of us can enjoy the feelings of relief in our collective sobrieties, knowing today that we do, in fact, have a primary purpose. We're given the tremendous opportunity to share our experience, our strength, and our hopes with other people without judgment. Today, all of us sitting in this room are involved in our fellowship. Many of us in different ways, but nevertheless involved. As I close, I want to remind us of that passage that many of us hear in our meetings. Many of us have it memorized. I'm going to share it. If you have it by memory, please join me in saying, abandon yourself to God as you understand God. Admit your faults to Him and to your fellows. Clear away the wreckage of your past. Give freely of what you find and join us. We shall be with you in the fellowship of the Spirit, and you will surely meet some of us as you trudge the road of happy destiny. It does not say we skip up a yellow brick road. This is not that. This is an Oz. May God bless you and keep you all for that.
In Abe, we all have mentors. Arnold has been one such mentor to myself over the years, and I think I'm much better for it. Arnold also talked about looking into the eyes, looking into the souls of individuals. And you know, when you see the light go on, if you're working with newcomers and you see the light go on and you see their life change, once you've experienced that, how could you not want to be a part of it? So, Arnold, thanks for your message. Wonderful job. Next up, we have Eileen. Eileen hails from New York, so very much looking forward to hearing your message today, too.
Hi, everybody. My name's Eileen, and I'm an alcoholic. Hi, this is the regular Sunday afternoon meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, right? And everybody showed up. Out of what Bill W. called this welter of exciting and fearsome experience, the traditions, including our fifth tradition, were born. Phew, it's a big one. And as our serenity prayer suggests, our primary purpose is to stay sober and help other alcoholics to achieve sobriety. That's our job. Now, when I came into AA, my primary purpose was to find another drink and to find somebody who would help make sure the supply kept coming. And it took AA. I was brought to my knees. I was physically, mentally, and spiritually bereft when I washed up on the shores of AA. I was born in London. I'm not going to give you year by year. Whenever anybody says, I was born, whenever. Oh, also, at these meetings, we give our sobriety date. My sobriety date is June 9th, 1973. Yes. One day at a time. I'm on the 24-hour plan. Anyway, I was born in London and grew up with regular drinking, but I loved it. Then when I got older and I could drink better, I had blackouts, I had headaches, I had the most incredible pain, and I thought nothing of it. I thought, you know, if you have a drink, you're going to have to pay for it, that's all. I had no concept I hated people who were vegetarians. I hated people in those days who didn't smoke. I hated people that went to the beach. You know, I was a night owl. I was the piano bar. I was a hippie in the park, in Central Park. I was different. Well, I was different because I was a drunk. And like many good drunks, I met another drunk. I liked it if you drank more than I did. I didn't have to feel so bad then. But like, we're all doing it. We're all getting drunk. No. They were getting married. They were having children. They were having big careers. And I met and married a wonderful guy. I met him in the bar, and he was a drunk. And he died of this disease at age 40. So you know where that marriage went. Nowhere. We were both dead drunk by the 7 o'clock news every night after work. And my life narrowed. I did a lot of stuff. I traveled. I had a good job. But my life narrowed and narrowed. And I was so exhausted by the time I was 29. I didn't know how they got up and did it every day. I'm in New York, so I'd see people opposite me on the subway, very diverse people, and I'd think, how are they doing this every day? And I was never suicidal, but at the end of my drinking, I remember thinking, well, if a truck was to hit me so that it was instant, you know, I could solve my problem, because I don't know how to live. I don't know how to live. I liked a guy at work, and he told me, we used to drink on the lunch hour. We also had a guy in the mail room who had one water cooler and one vodka cooler. And if he liked you, you could go down and get a snort about 10:30 to get you through to lunchtime. Anyway, this guy at work, he told me he'd come to AA, and I didn't know what AA was. And he said to me, Eileen, would you like to come to a meeting with me? And I said, No, I'm glad you're doing this. But it got my attention because I was very interested in this guy. And I would have gone to the supermarket with him. But I didn't go. So he carried the message to me. And then it got worse, you know, the blow by blow. It got worse. And one day, it was a Saturday afternoon, it was no worse than any dreary Saturday in June where I could see the fingerprints on the glass from which I was drinking, where I was too tired to get ice. So I just went into the bathroom, turned the tap on for a little bit of water. I put it down. And it was like a horror movie. It seemed like the glass was getting bigger and bigger and bigger. You know those things? And I thought, I don't want to drink it. I don't want to drink it. And I drank it. And I was so low that I went to the phone and I called AA. And the guy said, may I help you? And I said, I don't know, but I think I want to go to an AA meeting. He said, whereabouts are you living in Manhattan? I said, I can't tell you that. You know, it's Alcoholics Anonymous. There's about 1,000 meetings a week in Manhattan. So he said, all right. And so my first meeting, I was drunk, going into a blackout in a neighborhood not my own in Manhattan. And the only thing I remember from that meeting is a guy touched my elbow and says, it gets better. And the next day I had a meeting book tucked in my jacket pocket with a woman's name on it. Never met her from that day to this. She was leaving town, and I called the number. And she said, you must go to a meeting this afternoon. It was a Sunday afternoon, and I was 89 pounds and dying. And I said, well, I don't know if I can go this afternoon. You know, like, really? She said, you get your ass over to a meeting. What a stranger. I'm like, really? And I went. And I went into that room, and my higher power, I choose to call God, said to me, leave here and you're gone. Stay. Remember last night the guy was saying, stay? And I stayed. And a day at a time, I got sober. And when I was 90 days sober, I made the coffee. And I drink coffee, but my roots are from London. And I put two cans of coffee in where I should have put one. And the first guy that filled his coffee said, oh, my God, who made this coffee? And I wanted a drink. My aunt died with cancer, and I wanted a drink. I lost my umbrella. I wanted a drink. That didn't matter. But I started to get sober. When I was about a year sober for me, I had a sponsor. Somebody asked me, Lee, asked me if I would sponsor her. And I thought, what is she talking about? I'm like a newcomer. But I was a year sober. So I started to sponsor people. And closer to the mic. Okay. So I was involved in sponsorship. I got involved in the steps. I wanted to be buried under the floorboards of my home group. It was us against the world. I got into the steps, and my viewpoint broadened a little bit. I understood that it's us in the world, that I had a job to carry the message. And when I was a year or so sober, somebody went out, and we went to visit her, 12th step. And this woman had 17 cats that had not been fed in 3 days. And we opened the door, and these cats came flying in all directions. And I thought, I don't know if I can do this job. But I did. And I did service jobs with the help of so many other people, the wonderful, wonderful people that have gone before me. Then I worked as an editor. And one day somebody contacted me. I did public information as well. And somebody said to me, you know, somebody's retiring at GSO. You would be really good for that job. And I said, I know that's where the big book comes from, but, you know, I didn't know that much. I was involved with Intergroup and CNE. Anyway, I ended up going to GSO, and I worked on the staff assignments here at GSO for 14 years. And it was a wonderful experience. Yeah. Yeah. And it's a humble program, but if you like San Diego, that one was mine. What is it about? It's not about you having to be me. It's not about you having 3 minutes sobriety or 48 years sobriety. It's about bringing the love, bringing the love, bringing the acceptance. That's our job. That's our calling, whether we got a fancy job or we don't have a fancy job. Whether you're making coffee or whether you can't bear to do it at least until next time. Whether you're, you know, delegate, meeting goer, whether, you know, you want to kill him or her the minute you get out of bed. Okay, that's life. But we have a calling. And the calling is to stay sober and to carry the message of AA, the inclusive, beautiful message of AA, which is don't drink, get on the 24-hour plan, get busy. You may be unemployed, but you have a job to do. You have a job. and it's a job that nobody else can do. Nobody. I don't care who it is, you know, name any famous, wonderful person, Martin Luther King, Mother Teresa, whoever you want to, they're not in your kitchen, and they're not going to be. You're there. You're in that office. You're the one, and nobody but you can do it. I was given a gift. I did not earn it. My husband died of alcoholism. I remarried a darling guy in AA, and I now have grandchildren. But that beautiful guy, what did I have that he didn't have? He was beautiful. I didn't do it. But I was given the gift. You have been given the gift. If you are sitting here, you have been given the gift. You have been called to not pick up a drink today and to carry the message to the suffering alcoholic, the person in some kind of poverty, physical, mental, and spiritual, that equals a whole person who can be sober in AA and live a beautiful, beautiful life. I want to give a shout out to the Greenwich Village Group of New York City. I want to thank Ray and Arnold. I want to give a shout out to Eva S., who coordinated this convention and is always in the background. And if I didn't know you any better, I'd think you might be here for Clancy. Thank you.
Well, I tell you, I'm really impressed that everybody stuck around for all our speakers today. Of course, I'm being a little bit facetious here. You know, Eileen talked about the fact that we need one another. Nobody walks this path alone. We all need people to help us. And I think of Eileen's service at the General Service Office, all the work that she did with us for 14 years. I have to tell you, as a delegate, people back in the areas, whether it's your chair, your alternate chair, we need people like that at our General Service Office. They're all so compassionate. They're all so loving. And I have to tell you, some of us, as we go through that journey in service work, we're not all so loving and compassionate from time to time. And yet they have so much patience with us. They're willing to teach with us, work with us, and show us the way. And I have to tell you, I owe them so very, very much. Like I say, none of us walk alone. We all have our sponsors, but we have other people in our lives that have played a real key role, and Eileen is one of those people for myself. Anyhow, our next speaker, I don't know if any know Clancy. Clancy's been around for a while. I think he's likely spoke at pretty much every one of these conferences that we've had. And just before I turn it over to him, I really need to say thanks to Eva, too, our conference coordinator, or not our conference coordinator, but our international convention coordinator. I ran into her last night, and she was just exhausted. She was exhausted. It takes a lot of work to put these on. So one more big round of applause for Eva. And I needed to do that before I brought Clancy up, because after that, everything will kind of be up in a roar. So anyway, Clancy, come on up.
My name is Clancy Immelsund, and I'm an alcoholic. I have a frog in my throat. I'm going to do my Lewis, never mind. Anyway, I really enjoyed the meeting. I enjoyed listening to Arnold give a very precise talk, and to Eileen give a very human talk. And Someone said to me before the meeting, I remember that white coat from last time you talked. And I will tell you, that's exactly true. I wear this coat once a year, once every 5 years, when I get asked to speak at the International Convention. I've worn it for 8 times now, the last 40 years. It indicates purity. But we've had an excellent meeting today, and I want to talk a little bit about, just for the fun of it, about the traditions, because we forget sometimes how important they are. The traditions so often in groups are just used to have a newcomer read it to see if they can pronounce autonomy, or if they can say anonymous or anonymity. But I want to just for a minute talk about where they came from. We all know that in 1941, the Saturday Evening Post published an article on AA that made it just boom all over the country. Every city had an AA group for a while. And about 1942, end of 42, beginning of 1943, let me say one thing. My sobriety date is October 31st, 1958. I'm sure I am one of the few people here that ever sat and talked to Bill Wilson for an hour. And I'll tell you what, I was in New York in 1963 on a job. I had a free day. I thought, I've been sober 5 years. I'm going to go over and see Bill Wilson. So I went to the World Service office. I said, I see Bill Wilson. He said, well, he's booked up for a month. I can get you in next month. I said, no, I won't be here. Never mind. So I went to the archives and started looking through pictures. And here comes Bill Wilson. He says, are you the young man who wanted to talk to me? I said, yes, sir. He said, well, my 11 o'clock didn't show up. Come on in. And we talked for an hour. And you know what he said? I don't remember. I was more concerned with what he thought about me than what he was saying. But anyway, where were we? Oh, yes, 1943. Bill started getting letters into the office saying, take us off your mailing list. Our group is dissolved. We had a fight over money. We had a fight over this or that. And every week, more and more letters came in. And he was kind of frantic. In 1944, there was a flood came in. And he realized, my God, AA is going extinct. And so in the early 1945, what he tried to do in an effort to keep the thing going, he started the Grapevine in a big tabloid size. He said, if they read each other's stories, maybe they'll hold them together. But it didn't help them that much. In the summer of that year, a doctor in North Carolina wrote a letter to Bill with an article for the Grapevine saying, do you know that 100 years ago, there's a movement just like ours, more successful than we are? And no. So he read about the Washingtonians. Now, we hear a little bit about it, but not much. But in 1840, a guy got out of jail in Baltimore, another drunk, came back to his friends, 5 friends, and said, that chaplain says he knows how I feel. He doesn't know how I feel. You guys are the only guys who know how I feel, and you're all drunk too. What difference does that make? But they said, well, maybe we could help each other stay sober. When you feel like getting drunk, you talk to me. When I feel like getting drunk, I'll talk to you, because you know how I feel. So they drew up a contract, elected 5 officers and 1 member. Looked like the seating plan for last night's meeting. But at any rate, people are saying, you drunken fools, you can't keep yourself sober. What the hell are you doing trying to keep each other sober? But they stayed sober. They talked about each other. And some people came down from Philadelphia, and they started a little Washingtonian meeting in Philadelphia. Started one in Washington. Started one in Boston, which became very successful. At the end of the year, they had over 200 sober alcoholics. Unbelievable. At the end of their second year, they had several hundred, and they were doing very well, except a lot of people seemed to think they were just a bunch of screwballs. So he said, we're going to take Washington's birthday as our anniversary, February 22nd. On that date, invite somebody from your community to come in and give a talk. We don't care what they say, but we want them to see that the work we're doing and go back and report it. So all over the country in 1842, in Springfield, Illinois, the guy they got was a young guy named Abraham Lincoln. And he came in the Book of Lincoln speeches. You'll see a message to the Washingtonians, February 22nd, 1842. And much of it was just boilerplate. But near the end, he said, I know all of you men. I've worked with you men. And I know what you're doing. And I share your knowledge, except I don't have your thirst. I don't understand your thirst. But I hope you can keep it going. And I'm going back to tell my friends what kind of men you are. And so by 1845, now just listen to this. It was estimated they had 100,000 sober alcoholics. AA, after 5 years, didn't have 1,000. And we had telephones and radios. They had nothing. And their leaders got together, and they thought, well, we've pretty much sobered up all the alcoholics that we know of. Maybe we're being too insular. Maybe we should be spread out. Maybe we should help people who have narcotics problems, not cocaine and heroin like today, but laudanum and opium then. Maybe we should help people with emotional problems. Maybe we should help people who are having problems in their marriages. We can share with them. Great. And they just all took off. New zeal. Let's go get them. And by 1848, the Washingtonians were extinct. And they all died drunk, with very few exceptions. I had a book home written by one of the few survivors in 1861. I had it, though I lent it to some newcomer, and he never brought it back. Love is the answer. But I'm going to catch him someday. And he talks about, we were doing so well, but when people came to us with drinking problems, we didn't have time for them anymore. We had other things to do. And Bill read that, and how their groups had fought over money and who's going to be in charge. And he read these things, and he read the letters he was getting from all over the country, canceling AA groups. He said, my God, it's so similar. And so in a last gasp effort, in the mid-1950s, long after it had started, he sat down and wrote the 12 traditions based on the Washingtonian experience as well as the AA experience. And he issued them one by one in the grapevine and raised just that storm of complaint. We're not here to any goddamn rules. We're here for love. And they wrote letters, and people shook their fists and fought. And, you know, you may have read about it. Bill put his wife in the sidecar of his motorcycle and drove all the meetings he could get to, explaining that this is not rules. These are just suggestions to save us. But didn't go very well. People in California were complaining. People in Chicago were complaining, all over. And so Bill and Dr. Bob thought, we have to do something. But they had a little problem, because Bob's followers in Akron did not like the people in New York. The people in New York did not like the people in Akron. They said they were shit kickers. But Bill and Dr. Bob got together and they said, well, we can't depend on these people. Let's have one meeting, big meeting, where we'll sell these traditions. So they selected Cleveland in July of 1960 or 50, And they had people came from all over. And I have the tapes of that meeting. That's interesting. The quality of the tapes is terrible, but the quality of the contents is good. But Bill Wilson gave a talk on Friday night, which he did every Friday night from then on. And Dr. Bob gave his last talk. He was dying of cancer. He was trying desperately to convey what he'd found. In fact, his talk is just such a remarkable talk. In fact, it's on the wall of the World Service Office as you get off the elevator in its entirety. He started off by not being very much to say, you know, I'm going to welcome you all to Cleveland and hope you'll go back and tell the boys and girls in your group that we get as much out of A as we put it. Just talk. Now, I want to apologize for my ill health. My health hasn't returned the way I thought it would. I've been in bed the last few months. He said, and just talk like that. But finally, he said, I would like to call your attention to two or three things that I think are important. And then he gave what many people conceive to be the Gettysburg Address of Alcoholics Anonymous. And in about 2.5 minutes, he said, first, let us remember to keep our program simple. Let's not louse it out with Freudian complexes, which may be of interest to the scientific mind, but has nothing to do with our work here. Our work here consists of love and service. And we all know what love is. Just, that's for you, Dr. Bob, not me. He said, we all know what love is. We all know what service is. Secondly, he said, let us guard that erring member, the tongue, and use it with kindness and understanding. And there isn't a person in this massive room tonight, or any room like it, that does know exactly what it means. When things are going our way, God loves the answer. But let somebody cross us. One of the funniest things about AA I know of, everybody in this room fought the word alcoholic as long as they could. I'm not an alcoholic, you hear me? But after you're sober a while and you're really pissed off at somebody, you say, I don't even think he's alcoholic. And finally he said, none of us would be here today if someone hadn't taken the time to explain things to us, to take us to a few meetings, to give us a pat on the back when we needed it. Let us never reach that stage of smug complacency where we cannot do this. He said it a little bit differently than that, but that's what he meant. And great, great talk. It's just true in this room. It's just true all over the world in AA as it ever was in 1950. It's still the truth. But then they had six young guys. I don't know who they were, but you could just sense their tails wagging. They just were lively. They each took two forms, two traditions in the long form, and explained them. These are not designed for rules. These are designed to help us, to based on our experiences. And they gave just wonderful talks. And then Bill got up. Bill was a great man, but he was a very human man. The great thing about AA is made up of humans. Oh, God, there's some humans. But he looked around the room. They didn't have anywhere near this many people. Maybe this many people. And he wasn't sure he had the votes for the traditions. And so he said, you have heard the traditions read. Seeing no objections, they're accepted. And saved our bacon, saved our bacon. And those traditions are based kind of on what they felt to be the number one problems. Unity was first, because people were fighting all over the country. Unity. And then some people were saying, oh, this is just a scam for Bill Wilson to run the AA. And so, Bill is not running AA, it's a group conscience. And you have to have a desire to drink in order to be a member. And no group can tell another group what to do. Then they finally got around to the meat of what they're talking about. We, let's see, our primary purpose is to stay sober and carry the message to alcoholics who still suffer. There's a school of thought that feel that should be the first tradition, because that is really the name of the organization here. We keep our own sobriety. We forget, he didn't talk about that much. You know, our prime purpose is not talked about at all in the big book. Because when they wrote that big book, that was years away from the traditions. That was just staying sober. And now they got a way to stay sober without fighting and choking each other. They're going to do, every group is autonomous and all these things. And it may really work them over. And it's a number, really numbers one thing. We sometimes forget in our efforts. Our number one project is to stay sober. And the number two project is to remember you stay sober by helping somebody else. It's a one... And they learned that painfully when they got sober. When Bill sat with Dr. Bob in Akron, Ohio, and they talked about the Oxford movement, and Dr. Bob just expanded. Yeah, that's it, that's it. And he went to the American Medical Association convention, came back dead drunk. And they realized knowing spirituality doesn't keep you sober. Bill realized what he had done in New York was trying to help people. That's how he had stayed sober. So that's what we got to remember to do. We have a two-edged sword there. We must stay sober, and we stay sober by helping others. And the it's hard to remember that sometimes. We get caught up in the business of AA and all the panels and boards and things that are necessary, but we can sometimes forget what we're here for. We are here for the same reason that Bill Wilson called out Dr. Bob in 1935. It is always the same. One alcoholic talking to another alcoholic to help him reduce his feelings of... Shut up! Traditions are accepted. Okay. One alcoholic talking to another alcoholic to help him reduce his feelings of being different, at least enough so that he will try to take a step he does not yet believe in. And when that moment comes, that is the ember of sobriety. Then you got to blow on it. And you surround yourself by people doing the same thing and stay away from the sharpshooters and the hip, slick, and cool guys. And keep doing it. And pretty soon you get a little fire going. I think that's amazing. I have a... I'm still active at AA. As I told a group yesterday, I'm active, I'll tell you why I've been active in AA, and still am in my group, is because when I was about 35 years sober, 20 years ago, I just went through a little period where I just got sick of AA. Sick, not AA, but sick of the liars and cheats and phonies and quitters and... I said, I'm not going to go to meetings anymore. They're ruining me. So I stayed home and read my book. At the end of a month, I was just feeling great. Only one thing was wrong. Everybody around me had turned into an asshole. So I went back to AA briefly to shape them up. And I'm still here. I'm not here for me, I'm here for you. But the interesting thing about that first convention in Cleveland, that went over so well, they said, let's have another one. It'll take us 5 years to set it up. Let's have it in St. Louis. Then they said, great, let's have another one in Los Angeles in 1960. And I went to that as a newcomer and heard Ebby and Lois, and I kissed Sister Ignatia at that convention. Then I thought, maybe I shouldn't have done that. But I think she said, as long as you don't get in the habit. Yeah. But this convention is the outgrowth of a group of people trying to get together to accept the traditions. That's what we're about. That's what we're here for. And that's what we have to follow in our groups. And to wind it up, at the end of Dr. Bob's talk, he knew he was dying. He was trying to say one thing best he could. He said, this to the end, that our great blessings may never spoil us, that we shall forever live in awe of he who presides over all. And he sat down and was dead soon thereafter. But he left us to remember, because it's true today in Atlanta. We are all together under the aegis of he who presides over us all. And if we will let him, he will bless us. Thank you.